You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Manifestations of Karma. This is Lecture 2, entitled Karma and the Animal Kingdom, given in Hamburg on the 17th of May, 1910. Before we come to the question of human karma, a number of preliminary considerations are necessary. Yesterday I gave you a kind of description of the concept of karma, and today I shall have to say something about karma and the animal kingdom. In the course of this cycle of lectures, I shall discuss what might be called external evidence of the reality of karmic laws, whenever there is a good reason to point specially to such external evidence. You will find that through this you will acquire the ability to speak about karma and its underlying reason to other people, who may raise one question or another about it, or doubt the concept of karma as a whole. But let us first develop the background to this. What is more natural than to ask how animal life and animal fate are related to what we call the course of human karma? This encompasses, after all, the most important and incisive questions of man's destiny. The relation of man on the earth to the animal kingdom differs with the various epochs and also with the various peoples. It is certainly not without interest to see that in the case of the peoples who have preserved the best parts of the ancient sacred wisdom of humanity, there is a deeply sympathetic and loving treatment of animals. For example, in the Buddhist world, which has preserved important parts of the old conceptions of the world held by mankind in ancient times, we find a very sympathetic treatment of animals, a treatment and a feeling toward the animal kingdom which many people in Europe cannot yet understand. You will find it among other peoples too, especially where a nation has preserved some of the ancient inherited wisdom in one place or another. You will find a kind of friendship, something approaching a human treatment of animals. An example is the Arab and his treatment of his horse. In contrast to this, it can hardly be denied that in those parts of the world where a kind of world view of the future is being prepared in the Western countries, there is little understanding for such sympathetic attitudes toward the animal kingdom. And it is also remarkable that the idea of the animal as a non-sentient being with no special soul life, the idea of the animal as a kind of automaton, should have emerged in the course of the Middle Ages, right until our day, in those very countries where the Christian worldview was spreading. And it has been pointed out, perhaps not without reason, if not always with great understanding, that this idea advanced by a great body of Western philosophy, that animals are automatons and possess no actual soul, has trickled down into those parts of the population where there is no compassion for the animal and where there is often no limit either to the cruelty meted out to animals. Indeed, things have reached a point where the thoughts of a great philosopher of modern times, Descartes, about the animal kingdom have been thoroughly misunderstood. Of course, we must clearly understand that the idea of animals as mere automata has never been put forward by any of the really eminent souls of Western culture. Neither did Descartes hold this view, although in many books on philosophy you may read that he did so. But that is not true. It is true that he does not ascribe to the animal a soul which is able to develop to where it can prove, for instance, the existence of God out of its own consciousness of self. Nevertheless, he does say that the animal is permeated and animated by the so-called spirits of life, which, though they do not present such a complete individuality as the capital I of man, do nevertheless work as soul in the animal organization. It is indeed characteristic that one should have been able to misunderstand Descartes so completely. For this shows us that in past centuries there has been the tendency in our Western development to ascribe to the animal something merely automatic. We should not have misunderstood this had we gone to work conscientiously, but we have read it into Descartes. It is the characteristic of Western civilization that it had to be developed out of the elements of materialism. One may even say that the dawn of Christianity took place in such a way that this important impulse in human evolution was first planted into a materialistic Western mentality. The materialism of modern times is only a consequence of the fact that even the most spiritual of religions, Christianity, was at first conceived of in purely materialistic terms in the West. It is, after all, the destiny of Western humanity, of the Western nations, that they have to work their way up from the low grounds of materialism and develop, through overcoming these materialistic views and tendencies, the forces which will lead to the highest spiritual life. It is a consequence of this destiny, this karma, that the peoples of the West have a tendency to consider animals as mere automata. Those who cannot penetrate into the working of spiritual life and can only judge by what surrounds them in the external world of the senses would, from the impressions of that world, easily arrive at an idea about the animal kingdom which places the animals on the lowest scale. On the other hand, conceptions of the world which still contain elements of the primordial spiritual truths, the ancient wisdom of humanity, preserved a kind of knowledge of what exists spiritually in the animal kingdom. And in spite of all misunderstanding, in spite of all that has crept into their views of the world and destroyed their purity, they have not been able to forget that spiritual activities and spiritual laws are active in the life and development of the animal kingdom. Thus, if on the one hand, because of our lack of spiritual conceptions, we are compelled to admit ignorance concerning the animal soul nature, we must not, on the other hand, deceive ourselves by applying directly to the animal kingdom that idea of karma which helps to understand human destiny and human karma, for this would be the result of a purely materialistic conception of the world. This must not be done. I have already pointed out yesterday that it is essential to consider the idea of karma with exactitude. We should go astray if we sought in the animal kingdom for instances of the recoil of an action on the being from which the cause has proceeded. We can only comprehend the vast ramifications of karmic law if we go beyond a single human life between birth and death and follow man through his consecutive reincarnations. Then we shall find that the recoil of a cause which we have set in motion in one life can only come into action in a later one. The regular law of karma stretches from life to life, and the effects of causes need not operate. Indeed, when we consider karma on the whole, quite certainly do not operate in the same life between birth and death. From the more elementary teachings of spiritual science, we already know that in the case of animals, we cannot speak of a reincarnation such as takes place with man. In the animal kingdom, we find nothing resembling that human individuality which is preserved when a person passes through the gate of death and lives a particular life in the spiritual world during the period from death to a new birth, in order then to enter existence again by a new birth. We cannot conceive of animal death in the same way as we conceive of human death. for all that we describe as the destiny of the human individuality after a person has passed through the gate of death is not the same in the animal kingdom. And if we were to believe that in an individual animal, which we have before us, we could look for the reincarnated being of an animal which had previously existed on the earth, as we can do in the case of man, we should be entirely wrong. Today there is a general tendency to view the phenomena of life superficially, with no regard to their inner nature. Hence the really great opposites, the fundamental differences between man and animal, are simply not perceived. From a purely materialistic point of view, the outward phenomenon of death seems to be the same in man as in the animal. So one may easily believe, when observing the life of an animal, between its birth and death, that the various phenomena in the individual life of the animal are comparable with those in the personal life of a human being between birth and death. But this would be quite wrong. That is why I would like to point out some of the essential differences between animal and man. To understand fully this fundamental difference between the animal and the human being, we need to take an objective view of what our senses reveal to us and relate this to the fruits of our thinking. We find a phenomenon to which attention is also drawn by scientists. However, they don't quite know what to make of it, namely the phenomenon that man has really to learn the simplest things. In the course of his history, man has had to learn the use of the most primitive tools, and our children still have to learn the simplest things, and have to spend a certain time in order to learn them. Man has to make efforts to produce even the simplest things, or to manufacture his instruments and tools. When, on the other hand, we observe the animals, we are obliged to admit that how much easier it is for them in this respect. Think how the beaver builds its complicated dwelling. It does not need to learn. It knows how to do it, because it brings the knowledge with it as an inherent law, just as we human beings bring with us the art of changing our teeth at about 7 years of age. No one needs to learn that. In the same way, animals, such as the beavers, bring with them the capability to build their houses. If you observe the animal kingdom, you will find that the animals bring with them definite capacities by which they can achieve things which human art, great as it is far from achieving. The question may now arise, how does it come about that when a human being is born, he is less capable than, for example, a hen or a beaver, and that he has first, with great pains, to acquire what these creatures already bring with them? This is a very important question. And we need, above all, to develop a sense or feeling for the importance of this question. For it is much more relevant to our view of the world that we should be able to put the right question than that we should acquire masses of knowledge. Facts may be right, but they need not always be essential to our world view. Although we shall today go into the causes of these phenomena from the standpoint of spiritual science, it would carry us too far if we were to show in detail why this is so. But I will refer to it in a few words. If, with the aid of spiritual science, we go back into human evolution in the primeval past, we shall find that the forces which are at the disposal of the beaver or any other animal, in order that they should bring such artistic powers into the world, were at one time at the disposal of human beings. It is not that man, in a primordial past, missed this endowment of capabilities, while the animals took them all for themselves. He also received these powers, indeed in a far greater degree than the animals. For, although the latter bring a certain great artistic skill into the world with them, This is, however, limited in extent. Fundamentally, at birth, the human being can do nothing at all, and he has first to learn everything which concerns the outer world. This is somewhat strongly expressed, but you will understand what I mean. When a human being learns, it is soon shown that he can become many-sided, and that, as regards the development of certain artistic capacities, as well as others, this can be far richer than that of an animal. So the human being originally brought with him more abundant powers, which he does not bring today. The peculiar phenomenon comes to light that originally man and animal were similarly endowed. And if we were to go back to the old Saturn evolution, we should find that there was absolutely no difference between human and animal development. All these capabilities were common to both. What then has happened in the meantime, that the animal now brings with it into existence all sorts of capacities, while human beings are really clumsy when they come into the world? How has man behaved in the meantime that he now no longer possesses all he once brought with him? Has he foolishly wasted it in the course of evolution, while the animals have preserved it like thrifty housekeepers? These are perfectly legitimate questions. Man has not wasted these powers, which today the animals manifest as external capacities. He has only transformed them, but into something which differs from what the animals possess. They have applied them to external works. Beavers build their homes and wasps their nests, but man has transformed and incorporated within himself the same forces which the animals manifest outwardly. And by this means, he has brought into being what we call his higher human organization. In order that human beings should be able to walk upright, in order that they should have a more perfect brain, and in general a more perfect inner organization, certain forces were necessary, and these are the same forces with which the beaver constructs his dwelling. The beaver builds his home, but the human being has turned the forces inward upon himself, to his brain, etc., and so he has nothing left over with which to work outwardly. So if we, at the present time, move among the animals with a more perfect constitution, it is due to the fact that we have applied inwardly all the forces that the beaver expends in an outward way. We have our beaver building within us, and therefore we are no longer able to manifest these forces outwardly in the same way. When we take a comprehensive view of the world, we understand the origin of the various capacities which exist in creation, and how they appear to us today. Why had man to turn toward an inner organization the special forces which we see manifested in the external achievements of animals? Because only by acquiring this inner organization could man become the vehicle of what at the present time is the capital I, which progresses from incarnation to incarnation. No other organization could have become this bearer of the I, because it depends altogether upon the external shrine whether an I individuality is able to be active in the earthly existence or not. It could not do so if the external organization were not suited to the I individuality. Everything contributed to making this organization thus suitable, and to this end, a particular arrangement had to be made, the essentials of which we already know. We know that the moon evolution preceded the earth evolution. Before that again was the sun evolution, which was preceded by a Saturn evolution. When the ancient moon evolution came to an end, man was at a stage of development, as regards his external life, which may be described as animal-human, or animal-humanity. At that time, this external human organization had not progressed far enough for it to become the vehicle of an I individuality. It was the earth evolution of man which had the task of embodying the I in this organization. But this could only come about by regulating our earth evolution in a very special way. When the old moon development came to an end, everything dissolved, so to speak, into chaos. After an appropriate period of cosmic twilight, the new cosmos of our earth evolution came forth. In it was contained everything which, as our solar system, is connected with us and the earth. From this whole, from this cosmic unity, there split off all the other planetary bodies belonging to our special earth existence. We need not go into the manner in which the other planets, Jupiter, Mars, etc., split off. We have only to point out that at a certain period of our earth phase of evolution, our earth and our sun separated. While the sun had already separated and was sending down its activities to the earth from outside, our earth was still united with the present moon, so that the substances and spiritual forces which at the present day belonged to the moon at that time were still united with the earth. We have often touched upon the question as to what would have happened if the sun had not split away from the earth and passed over into that condition in which it works on the earth from outside, as it does now. In the beginning, when the earth was still united to the sun, the conditions were quite different, and the whole cosmic system included the ancestors of the human organization, making one unity. It is absurd to look at modern conditions and say, "What nonsense those anthroposophists talk! If that had been so, all beings would have been burnt up." But these beings were so organized that at that time they could exist under conditions quite different from those of this epoch. If the sun had remained in union with the earth, forces very different and much more violent would have remained with the earth. And the consequence would have been that the whole evolution of the earth would have progressed with such violence and speed that it would have been impossible for the human organization to develop as it should. Therefore, it was necessary that the earth should be given a slower tempo and denser forces placed at its disposal. This could only be brought about by the withdrawal of the violent and stormy forces from the earth. The forces of the sun worked less violently when acting from outside after withdrawal from the earth. Through this, however, something else took place. The earth was now in a condition in which mankind could again not progress in the right way. The state of the earth was now too dense, and it exercised a drying and petrifying action on all life. If conditions had remained so, man would have again been unable to develop. This was remedied by a special arrangement. Some time after the exit of the sun, the present moon left the earth and took away the retarding forces which would have brought all life to a slow death. Thus the earth remained behind, between sun and moon, selecting exactly the right tempo for the human organization, enabling it to take up an I and to be the bearer of the individuality which goes on from incarnation to incarnation. The human organization, as it exists today, was produced from the cosmos under no other conditions than through this process, first the separation of the sun and then that of the moon. Someone might perhaps say, "If I had been the Almighty, I would have done it differently. I would very soon have produced such a combination that the human organization would have been able to progress in the manner it had to progress. Why was it necessary that first the sun had to withdraw, and then after a time the moon?" The person who thinks in this way thinks much too abstractly. He does not reflect that when, in the universal order, so complex a thing as the human organization is to be produced, a special arrangement is necessary for each single part. One cannot convert into reality what human thought invents and imagines. Abstractly, one can think anything, but in true spiritual science, one has to learn to think concretely, so that one says, the human organization is not a simple thing. It consists of a physical body, an etheric body, and an astral body. These three parts had first to be brought into a particular equilibrium, so that the several parts should be correctly related to one another. This could only take place through this threefold process. First, the formation of the unitary cosmos, the entire cosmic unity of Earth, Sun, and Moon together. Then something had to be done that would work in a retarding way on the human etheric body, which would otherwise have consumed all evolution too fiercely. This was accomplished by the withdrawal of the Sun. Then again, the Moon had to be withdrawn, because otherwise, through the astral body, the human organization would have died. These three processes had to take place because of the human being's threefold organization. Thus we see that we owe our existence and our present qualities to a complicated arrangement in the cosmos. But we also know that the evolutions of all the kingdoms of nature do not by any means proceed at the same rate as the general evolution. From various lectures given in preceding years, we know that during each of the planetary incarnations of the Earth, certain beings have always remained behind the general evolution. Then, as evolution proceeds, they live in conditions which do not fully correspond to this evolution. We also know that fundamentally, all evolution can only proceed in the right way through the remaining behind of these entities. During the old moon evolution, certain beings remained behind as the luciferic beings, and through them much that is evil has resulted, but to them we also owe what makes human existence possible, namely the possibility of freedom, of the free development of our inner being. Indeed, we may say that in a certain sense, the remaining behind of the luciferic beings was a sacrifice. They remained behind so that, during the Earth existence, they would exercise certain activities. They could bestow on man the qualities which pertain to his dignity and self-determination. We must accustom ourselves to entirely different ideas from those which are customary. For, according to the usual ideas, one might perhaps say that the luciferic spirits failed to progress and had to remain behind, and we could not excuse their negligence. But it was not a question of the negligence of the luciferic beings. In a certain sense, their remaining behind was a sacrifice, in order that they might be able to work on our earthly humanity through what they acquired by this sacrifice. From the last lecture, you already know that not only beings, but also substances remained behind, and preserved laws, which in previous planetary conditions were the right ones, and then carried those laws into the later evolution. Thus, phases of evolution belonging to ancient times mingle and interpenetrate with those of modern times. And it is this which brings about such great complexities in life, which offers us the most diverse degrees of existence. The animal kingdom could never have developed alongside the human kingdom today if certain beings had not remained behind at the end of the Saturn period, in order, while mankind on the Sun was already developing a stage higher, to form a second kingdom and come forward as the first ancestors of our present animal kingdom. Thus, this remaining behind was absolutely necessary for subsequent developments. A comparison may explain why beings and substances had to remain behind. The development of man had to progress by degrees, and it could only do this in the same degree to which man refined himself. Had he always worked with the same forces with which he had worked during the Saturn phase, he would not have progressed, but would have remained behind. For this reason, he had to refine his forces. As an illustration, let us suppose we have a glass of water in which substance is dissolved. Everything in this glass, from top to bottom, will be of the same color, the same density, etc. Now, let us suppose that the grosser substances settle at the bottom. Then the purer water and the finer substances remain above. The water could only be refined by separation of the grosser parts. Something like this was also necessary after the Saturn evolution had run its course, so that such a sediment appeared, and the whole of humanity separated from something, retaining all the finer parts. That which was left later formed the animal kingdom. By means of this separation, man was able to refine himself and rise a stage higher. At each step, certain beings had to be separated off, in order that man could rise higher and higher. Thus we have a humanity which has only become possible through man's freeing himself from the beings which live around him in the lower kingdoms. At one time, we were bound up with these beings, with all their forces, in the flow of evolution, like the denser constituents in the water. We have risen above them, and in this way our development has been made possible. Thus we look down upon the three kingdoms of nature around us, and see in them something which had to become a basis for our development. These beings have sunk in order that we might be able to rise. In this manner we look upon the subordinate kingdoms of nature in the right way. The study of the earth's development will help us to understand the details of this process still more clearly. We must be quite clear that all the facts in our earthly development have certain relationships and connections. We have seen that the separation of the sun and moon from the earth really came about in order that during the earth evolution, the human organization might be able to develop to the extent of becoming an individuality. And in conjunction with this, the human organization was made pure. But through this separation in the universe for man's sake, through this great change in our solar system, the other three kingdoms of nature were also affected, especially the animal kingdom. If we wish to understand the influence exercised upon the animal kingdom through the processes of the separation of the sun and moon, this is what we arrive at as a result of spiritual investigation. Man was at a certain stage of evolution when the sun separated. Now, had he been obliged to keep to this stage, at which he was during the period when the moon was still united to the earth, he would not have been able to attain his present organization. He would have been confronted with a certain wasting and drying up. The moon forces had first to go out. The possibility of this human organization we owe only to the circumstance that during the period when the moon was still part of the earth, man had preserved an organization which could still be pliable, for it might have been possible for his organization to become so set that the exit of the moon could no longer be of any use. Only the ancestors of humanity were at that pliable stage at which the organization was still possible. Therefore the moon had to separate at a particular time. What took place up to the time of the exit of the moon? The human organization became grosser and grosser. Human beings did not indeed look like wood. That would be too gross a conception. The organization at that time, in spite of its grossness, was still much finer than is our present organization. But for that period, between the exit of the sun and that of the moon, the organization of human beings was so gross that their more spiritual part, which in a certain sense lived alternately within and without the physical body, came at length to the crisis that when it wanted to re-enter its physical body, it found this so dense, owing to events that had taken place on the earth, that it could no longer enter into it as its dwelling. Hence it also came about that the spiritual and soul part of many of our human ancestors departed altogether from the earth, and for a certain time took refuge on other planets belonging to our solar system. Only a small number of the physical bodies could be used and were able to maintain themselves over this time. As I have said, by far the greater number of human souls went out into space. But the onward stream of human evolution was maintained by a small number of those who were more robust and who were able to struggle and conquer. These robust souls carried the evolution over the critical period. During the whole of this process, the human individuality was still not evolved. The group soul still prevailed. And when souls withdrew, they were absorbed into the being of the group soul. Then came the exit of the moon, which made it possible for the human organization to be further refined. It could then take up the souls which had previously soared away, and these souls gradually, up to and during the Atlantean epoch, came down again and entered into the human bodies below. But certain organisms had reproduced themselves during this critical time, and they could not become the vehicles of the human soul, as they were too gross. Through this it came about that side by side with those organizations which were able to be refined and to become the vehicles of human individuality, there had also been propagated organisms which could not. And these were the successors of the organisms that had been abandoned by the human soul during the time when the sun had already withdrawn and the moon was still united with the earth. Thus, side by side with man, we see a kingdom of organisms actually developing, which, by preserving the moon character, had become incapable of becoming bearers of human individualities. These organisms are essentially those which have become our present animal kingdom. It may seem curious that the grosser organisms of the present animals have certain capacities whereby they are able to act wisely, as, for example, in the work of the beaver. We must not conceive of these things simplistically, but be quite clear about the fact that these organisms, which had not received human souls, developed the outer animal form and a nervous system, as well as other characteristics that made it possible to attain total harmony with the laws of earthly existence. For those beings which did not evolve the capacity for taking up human souls remained united with the earth the whole time. The other organisms, which later became more refined in order to take in human individualities, were also connected with the earth. But because they had to undergo certain changes later on when the moon was outside, they lost these capacities, or rather transmuted them in refining themselves and in having to go through other changes. To sum up, when the moon had split away from the earth and certain organisms existed on earth which carried on reproducing along the lines developed when moon and earth were still connected, these organisms had remained gross, had preserved the laws which they had before, and had become so set that when the moon detached itself, no change took place in them. They simply propagated without change. The other organisms, which were to become the vehicles of human individualities, had to change. They could not perpetuate themselves rigidly as the grosser organisms did. They changed in order that the spiritual beings, which had not been connected with the earth at all in the meantime, which had been somewhere different altogether, could now work into them. So this is the difference between the beings which had preserved the old rigid moon character and those which had changed. Of what did the change consist? When the souls which had gone away from the earth returned and entered into physical bodies again, they began to make alterations to the nervous system, the brain, and so forth. They applied their forces, as it were, to inward construction. No change was possible in the other beings which had hardened. Different beings now took hold of these latter organisms. These beings had not yet evolved to a stage where they could work into the inner organisms. They worked from without, like the animal group souls. Thus the organisms that were suitably prepared received the human soul after the exit of the moon. And the beings pertaining to the human soul then worked on, perfecting what was to be the human organism. The organisms which had remained rigid during the moon period could not be changed. Beings which had not developed far enough to attain a distinct individuality, which had stopped evolving at the moon stage, henceforth took hold of these organisms as generic or group souls. Thus we are able to grasp the difference between human beings and animals out of the processes of the cosmos. These cosmic processes in the Earth's evolution produced two kinds of organism. If we had been prevented from developing our organisms beyond the stage immediately below the human stage, our eye would be hovering around the Earth now for want of a suitably flexible organism. We would not be able to descend, and in spite of having become more perfect beings, we would have had to remain at the stage of animal group souls. But because our organisms were capable of further refinement, we were able to take hold of them and make them our dwelling. In other words, we were able to descend to earth into physical bodies. The animal group souls felt no need to do this. They work into the beings concerned from out of the spiritual world. Thus, in the animal kingdom surrounding us, we see something that we should also have been today, if our present organization had not been transformed. Let us now ask how the animals, with their more rigid organisms, have appeared on the earth. They came down through us. They are the descendants of the bodies which we no longer wished to occupy after the exit of the moon. We left those bodies behind in order to find others later, and we should not have been able to find others later if we had not forsaken those at that precise time. For only after the exit of the sun could we continue our progress on the earth. We left behind us, as it were, certain beings, in order that we ourselves might find the possibility of rising higher. In order to rise higher, we had to go to other planets and leave the bodies below to go to ruin. And in a certain sense, we owe what we are to what remains below. Indeed, what we owe may be described in greater detail. We may ask how it was possible for us to leave the Earth during the critical period. After all, it cannot be taken for granted that beings just go where they please. For the first time in the Earth's evolution, something took place that we owe to the Luciferic spirits. They were our leaders and took us away from the Earth evolution at the critical period. It was as though they said to us, "Down below, a critical time is now coming, and you must leave the earth." We left the earth under the guidance of the Luciferic spirits, the same beings who brought into our astral body of that time the Luciferic principle, the tendency in us to all that we call the possibility of evil. But with it also came the possibility of freedom. Had they not taken us away from the earth at that time, we should always have been chained to the form that we had then created, and we should now at the most only be able to float above that form without ever being able to enter it. So they took us away and united their own being with our being. If we bear this in mind, we shall understand that during the time we went away, we took in the luciferic influences. Those other organisms which did not share in this destiny of being taken into very special regions of the world remained down below without the luciferic influence. They had to share our earthly destiny, but they could not share our heavenly destiny. And when we came back to the earth, we had the luciferic influence in us, but those other beings did not. This is made possible for us. This made it possible for us to lead a life in the physical body and yet have the possibility of becoming more and more independent of the physical body. Those other beings which did not receive the luciferic influence represent what our astral bodies were during the period between the exit of the sun and the moon, namely that from which we liberated ourselves. We look upon the animals and say, all that the animals manifest in the way of cruelty, voracity, and all animal vices, besides the skill which they have, we should have had within us, if we had not been able to eject them. We owe this liberation of our astral bodies to the circumstance that all the grosser astral bodies have remained behind in the animal kingdom of the earth. And we can say, how fortunate for us that we no longer have the cruelty of the lion, the slyness of the fox within us, that these have left us to lead an independent existence outside of us. Thus the animals have the astral body in common with us, and are therefore able to feel pain. But from what has now been said, we see that they do not possess the power to evolve through pain and through the conquest of pain, for they have no individuality. Therefore, animals are far worse off than we are. We have to bear pain, but each pain is for us a means to perfection. Through overcoming it, we rise higher. We have left behind us the animal as something that already has the capacity to feel pain, and does not yet possess the power to raise itself above pain and to overcome it. That is the fate of the animals. They manifest to us our own former organisms when we were capable of feeling pain, but could not yet, through overcoming the pain, transform it into something beneficial for humanity. Thus, in the course of our earth evolution, we have left our worst aspects to the animals, and they stand around us as tokens of how we ourselves came to our perfection. We should not have got rid of the dregs if we had not left the animals behind. We must learn to consider such facts, not as theories, but rather with a cosmic world feeling. When we look upon the animals, we should feel, you animals are outside. When you suffer something of which we reap the benefit. We, human beings, however, have the power to overcome suffering, while you must endure it. We have left the suffering to you, and have taken the power to overcome it. If we develop this cosmic feeling, out of the theory, it will grow into an all-encompassing sense of compassion for the animal kingdom. Hence, when this universal feeling sprang from the primeval wisdom of humanity, when mankind still possessed the remembrance of the primeval wisdom which told each one by a dim clairvoyant vision how things once were, the sense of compassion for the animal kingdom was equally preserved, and this sense of compassion was very highly developed indeed. It will come again when people accustom themselves to take up spiritual science, and when they understand once more how the karma of humanity is bound up with the world karma. In the so-called Dark Ages, when materialistic thought held sway, these connections could not be understood. At that time, one observed only what was side by side in space, without taking into consideration the fact that whatever is side by side in space has a common origin, and is only separated in the course of evolution. And naturally there was no feeling either of any connection between the human being and the animal. And in those parts of the earth where the mission was to cover up the consciousness of man's connection with the animal world, where it was replaced by a consciousness limited to external physical space, human beings have been paying their debt to the animals in a strange fashion, by eating them. However, these things also show us how the various views of the world are related to the world of human sensation and feeling. After all, sensations and feelings are a consequence of prevailing views of the world, and as concepts and ideas change, humanity's sensations and feelings change. The human being could not do otherwise but evolve. Other beings had to be pushed into the abyss to make possible the ascent of the human being. The human being could not give the animals an individuality, which compensates karmically for what the animals have to suffer. He could only give them the pain without the karmic law of compensation. However, when the human being has attained the freedom and selflessness of his individuality, he will be able to give them what he could not give them in earlier times. Then he will, in a conscious way, grasp the karmic law in this realm too. And he will say, "It is to the animals that I owe what I have now become. What I cannot give any more to individual animal beings, which have descended from an individual existence to a shadow existence. What I have once incurred in debt to the animal, as it were, I have to make good now toward the animals through the very way I treat them." Therefore, with the progress of evolution, through the knowledge of karma, the human being's relationship to the animal world will progress, too, beyond what it is now, especially in the West. The human being will raise up again what he cast down, and this will be reflected in his treatment of the animals. Thus we see that there is a certain relationship between karma and the animal kingdom, although we must not confuse matters by likening what the animal experiences as its fate with human karma. But if we consider the whole earth development and what had to come about for the sake of humanity and its evolution, we will see that we can indeed speak of a relationship between the karma of humanity and the animal kingdom. The end of Lecture 2.